Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is my Wardrobe Malfunction, the podcast for anyone who wears clothes, anyone who's interested in them, and anyone who isn't. So basically, everyone. This is the second episode of season 6, which means if you're just joining us, you've 41 episodes to catch up on. Hear Nadine Coyle telling us about falling off stage, Georgia Toffolo giving us some granny chic, and Reverend Richard Coles revealing the most hilarious insult I've ever heard. Later in this episode, we've got a musical treat from our house band duo, a track from their brand new album, Gig in Your Garden. But let's get on to today's guest. She's journalist, presenter, podcaster, and now jewellery designer, Kate Thornton. And I think of my special guest so far, her wardrobe malfunction is possibly the finest of all. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. Hello, everybody. So today I am delighted to welcome Kate Thornton, journalist, presenter, podcaster, and now jewellery designer, Kate. I've looked at BB Bijou.
Katie now, yeah, But
it's so fab.
Oh, do you know what? I'm so glad you said that. I was really nervous about you having a look.
No, seriously, it is so fab. It's exactly the kind of stuff I like because it's simple, but it looks really well made and it's affordable.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the struggle. From the moment I got involved with this, I just said, I'm not just going to turn up and wear stuff that somebody else has designed. I've got to have massive input. It's got to be quality and it's got to be affordable. You know, that sort of weird stage where you think, have I got something else in me? Is there something else? Is there more to me than walking and talking?
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I've spent the majority of my professional life doing. And I think there's a massive part of all of us that have this, you know, these segments in our brain that just aren't tapped into. But honestly, last night I was sat there thinking, oh no, Susanna's going to look at my jewellery collection. It's like handing it into your favourite tutor at the end of a degree. But I do loads of these really silly tests. Can I sleep in it? Can I shower in it? All that stuff.
But I think that's so important. I mean, because I love jewellery, but I like simple jewellery. And I like jewellery that I don't have to take off ever. Because if I have to take it off, then I lose it.
Totally. Sometimes it's nice to have foundation pieces that you can then layer. But you never have to really remove those foundation pieces. But equally, those pieces should be doing a lot of work on their own if you've not layered or over the top of them. I've had so much fun playing, and especially in a time when we're not really dressing up.
Yeah.
I've just been like a magpie in lockdown, playing clasps and stones. And now I'm wearing this. This just arrived this morning. We're shooting this next week. It's my first T-shirt that I'm wearing.
Oh, read my lips. What a great slogan.
I'm sorry, I'm literally pushing my bosom in your face now.
That's so fine. I love bosoms, you know that.
This is a lovely lady that I came across on Instagram. She's called Gina Potter, and she and her husband work from their kitchen in Bangor, and they do these beautiful lip designs. And I really loved her stuff, so I bought a piece. Then we started chatting, and I said, do you fancy collaborating? And this one is all of the names of some of my favourite love songs. And then we do another version, which is Words to Live By, which is things like, you know, walk tall, you know, throw your shoulders back. It's kind of words of wisdom, I suppose.
It's fantastic. And it's a good shape because it's slightly fitted and the neckline is just going down below the collarbone, which is really flattering.
Exactly. The neckline's so hard to get right. And also, you'll appreciate this, this bit here.
Yeah.
It was around the side panels.
We're just looking at back fat now.
Back fat, right? Because it's a thing.
Yeah.
You grow fat in places you've never even bothered to look.
Exactly.
It's only when you see yourself in some horrific angle on television and you go, oh, did I leave like a pair of knickers in my bra? Fat.
Now, my love, let's wind the movie back a little bit. You were born in Cheltenham. Did you grow up there?
Okay.
Bread, but not in the posh bit.
Okay. What were your parents doing? And do you have brothers and sisters?
One brother.
Is he?
Yes. So my brother's called James and he's 18 months younger than me. My mum and dad are Cheltenham born and bred. My dad worked as an engineer in a factory at night. And my mum had a variety of jobs when we were growing up to fit in around looking after us. She was our dinner lady for a while at school.
Yeah.
And she worked at Sainsbury's. And then she went on to run an office for a scaffolding company until she retired.
Yeah.
My dad would work nights and my mum would work days. So that enabled there to always be somebody at home for us. And they were such a team. I mean, we are a blue-collar working class family. And they kind of strived for a little bit more, I suppose. They were the only ones that bought property at their brothers and sisters. They were the first ones off the block, rather, not the only ones. And, you know, that went abroad. I remember when we went abroad on the coach when I was seven, we went to the south of France. Everyone, it was the talk of, like, have you seen our Dennis and Sandra taking those nippers? I think once we got a hovercraft, they were like, they're on a bloody hovercraft.
Oh, fantastic.
So yeah, I was born and raised in Cheltenham,
yeah,
which is a beautiful part of the world.
So your parents, hardworking parents, and that was clearly instilled into you because you were working from the age of 12, weren't you? You were finding jobs and you understood that if you wanted something, you had to get off your little butt, get out there and get the money for yourself.
Totally. So like by the age of 12, I was obsessed with ballroom dancing. So ballroom dancing was quite big in the area that I lived. And dance classes were, you know, I mean, we didn't have a lot of money. And so I used to go to this dance class every Saturday morning at the Freddie Clark School of Dance. So I struck a deal with them because I really wanted to do as many, many classes as I possibly could to get better at ballroom and Latin American dancing. So my trade was that I would teach the toddlers, kind of, you know, like the 3 and 4 year olds, like the basic cha-cha and jive and a bit of waltz really early on a Saturday morning. And then I could stay at the school for the rest of the day and have my classes, which I just thought was amazing. And then not far down the road from where the dance school was, my auntie Jill has still to this day has a hairdressing salon called the Beauty Box. And literally there's nine cousins on that side of the family who've all had Saturday jobs there. And we were all the champion girls. And yeah, so you go and you work for our Jill. That's what we're called R in our family. I'm our Kate.
Yeah.
Work for our Jill.
Yeah.
And then our Lindsay came in afterwards and then our Joanne. And then we've all been through this. It's like a rite of passage where you sit there, you make tea, you shampoo hair, you learn how to serve people and be a part of a team. And it was a brilliant, brilliant education and work for tips.
Yeah.
And so when did you develop an interest in clothes and as a child? I mean, you must have had an interest in the ballroom dancing clothes.
Well, ballroom dancing clothes, I mean, I had I would look longingly at you know, any images I could get hold of these amazing sort of slinky ballroom female ballroom dancers and their amazing dresses, the kind of stuff that, you know, you see now on Strictly. And we obviously, you know, those dresses cost a few quid. My mum would save with my dad, and they would buy me the secondhand version. So, but these were always from women who were much older than me. So I was like 12, and you'd have these big conical bra bits that literally, because I had no boobs, you could poke and it would just leave a hole.
Yeah.
And then I remember I said to my mum once, where did you get these from? I mean, there's some hideous pictures. And I would go and compete in these dresses, feeling like, you know, I mean, like, and my mum's an amazing seamstress, so she would take everything and alter it.
Yeah.
But I had this really quite horrific orange and black sequined Latin dress, that the sort of dress that if you did a big spin in it and you did the chop, you could make the dress stay up like they do in dirty dancing. I loved it so much. It was horrific. I look back now, I had the hair of Pat Butcher and
like a chocolate orange.
And I look like, you know, an 85-year-old woman competing in a beauty pageant in the dress. The dresses were, and they all smelt musty. And I sort of look back now and I think maybe were they from people who've passed away?
Oh my
like
God.
They were that old.
But I mean, how did you develop this love of ballroom dancing at such a young age? Had anyone in your family done it? It's such a random thing.
Well, it wasn't growing up then, because like boys did rugby or the football and girls went to dance classes, and it was quite normal. And you started out doing a little bit of ballet, and then if you sustained an interest, for me it was my weekly form of exercise, I guess. I was crap at sport at school, but I loved to dance, and I loved the way dancing made me feel. It was, you know, you know that once you nail it.
You know what? I never nailed it, and I loved every minute of it apart from the dancing, which I fucking loathed.
I mean, I was lucky enough to be okay at dancing, and we would do these local competitions, and my mum and dad, God love them, would drive me to like Birmingham to compete.
Yeah.
And then I joined, disco was just sort of happening then. And I joined the disco class and a formation disco team called the Scalamanders. And this is like the clothing was. I've still got pictures somewhere. We were all in white full cat suits, like full length, you know. Mm-hmm. And my mum was in a brilliant with a needle and thread. She would sew on all these sequins in silver and black.
It's quite Elvis.
Oh, totally. And then I had sequined leg warmers, and we would dance barefoot, and it was and I never felt more alive than I did in that horrific get-up.
No, I'm sorry, I think that sounds amazing, that get-up. The sequined leg warmers, I've never seen a pair of those before.
And these kind of like these sort of glove things that would sit on a hook around you, so fingerless, so that when you went like this and you pulled like sort of John Travolta moves in front of your eyes, your hands glittered.
Oh, sounds so amazing. But you were very young at this stage, and you've been very honest about your teenage years and where you were horrifically bullied at school, which then led to anorexia and body dysmorphia. So did the dancing help that?
It did, yeah. It definitely did, because it enabled me to see that, you know, my body was changing for sure. That was without, you know, that's just your rite of passage as you crash into puberty.
Mm.
The dancing did help. It was purely because it was somewhere safe for me to escape to. I loved music. It played into my love of music.
Mm.
I got pretty much on my own. I would get in, I've realised now at this stage and age of my life, I have quite obsessive tendencies. So when I do something, I really do it. So when I danced, I really danced. So I would get in from school, finish my homework, and then go and lock myself away with the family hi-fi stereo.
Yeah.
My disco music on, and just rehearse all night until I went to sleep.
Yeah.
I was quite obsessive. And then as I progressed, and you know, it was quite, it's really distressing when you start to see your body change and you don't like the changes. And I really didn't like the changes. So then I became quite self-conscious. So that obsession moved to a different place, and I stopped loving clothes. You know, I always used to save furiously so that I could. My mum ran the Freeman's catalogue on our estate, which is a way of her making a bit of extra money. And you know, our door was always ringing with kids dropping off their mum's club money, and then I get to choose something out of the catalogue once in a while, and it would be so giddy, and I'd save up my hairdressing Saturday job money to go into town and go to Tammy Girl or whatever it was. And then I started to lose interest in clothes because I hated my body, and all I wanted to do was disguise my shape and my form. And then actually when I got very thin, it became a desire to disguise for a different reason, because I didn't want to get caught out. I didn't want anyone to see how small I'd become, because they might stop me.
So for you, because there's so much anorexia around at the moment. You know, I have friends whose daughters are suffering, and it's horrendous.
My daughters, you know, I have a little boy that is really, really horribly aware of weight and abs and muscle, and he's 12.
Yeah, it's really tough. But I think so for you, that from what I understand, and I ain't no expert, but anorexia can come about when, like you say, you don't like the shape your body is turning into, which is that kind of when you reach puberty and it's almost like you want to cling on to your childhood and you're scared. The idea of becoming a woman is frightening.
No, not at all. It was just that I was in my eyes, I was fat.
Okay.
And, you know, I was, you know, at that point coming out of, you know, the ballroom scene, for example, anybody that you looked up to.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about elegant lines and you're surrounded by this kind of swan-like beings, you know, so elegant, beautiful. Or the disco dancers in skin-tight lycra, you know, there's nowhere to hide. You know, they're like leggings. It's, you know, what's that saying? There are three things that don't lie: children, drunk people, and leggings. Well, lycra I'd put into that as well. And so I was, and also I was being really quite badly bullied at school. And a lot of the jibes, a lot of what started it was about my size. So I figured that if I shrank, all those problems would go away. I'd like myself and they'd leave me alone. And then it became, in a period that felt very horribly out of control for me, it became about control. And I think that anorexia and bulimia are very much about people trying to grapple control at a time their world feels horribly out of control.
So do you think it stemmed specifically from the bullying?
Like a perfect storm.
Yeah.
But also, I went on to make a documentary about this a few years ago now, and it's still up on YouTube, and I still probably at least once a week receive a message from somebody who says, I've watched it and it's helped. And I explore my journey with eating disorders, but also the wider picture. And actually what I found out by going to the Maudsley Hospital in London was that some of us are just born predisposed to those triggers. And that's me, right? It was always there. Something, you know, I could have gone through life without any trigger and
so
never,
true.
Ever had an issue with food.
Yeah.
But you know what? I would never say that I'm thankful that I went through it, but I bloody learned a lot going through it. I learned about... Actually, having a great sense of willpower is a wonderful thing, but I put it into a really negative space. I used it to help to sort of destroy myself and to starve. I was convinced by a brilliant GP who treated me as a therapist. So no prescriptions were written. She just would sit with me and talk. She just said, imagine if you applied all of that hard work, that willpower, that tenacity into something that's going to have a really positive impact. Like, what do you want to do for a living? And I was like, I want to be a journalist. She said, you can't do that or you're starving your brain of oxygen every day. But imagine if you put this willpower. So she convinced me to transition that drive from a negative to a positive. And it was life-changing advice.
I'm going to pass that on to this friend of mine whose daughter is very sick. Yeah, it makes so much sense. And it's such a simple thing, because it's like you say, you can't prescribe anything for an eating disorder. And I think it's one of the hardest things to overcome. I mean, I'm an alcoholic and, you know, I reached a rock bottom and I was able to make changes and go into recovery and la, la, la. But with something like, you know, all these things are mental disorders, but with something like anorexia, I think it's so much harder from, you know, what I've read and heard.
I mean, listen, I've never been an alcoholic, but I recognise the similarities massively between, they are addictions.
Right? Yeah.
Like, you would have those moments of panic when you thought you couldn't drink. Well, that applies to an anorexic when they think they've got to eat and they don't have to.
So true.
And then... Now, I always become really super mindful of never sharing the things that I did to enable me to not eat, purge, because I don't ever want to be irresponsible in giving somebody a manual or like a how-to, because that can be really dangerous.
Yeah.
But I do recognise that a lot of what you go through as an alcoholic was on the secrecy, for a start, is a shared...
Yeah. Exactly, because the shame is so immense, you have to, you know, retreat into a private world, which is incredibly lonely.
It is. And every lie is covered with another lie.
Yeah.
So actually, you don't even know what the truth is yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that relief of, you know, for me, when, it, you know, my two best friends at school, both called Claire, confusingly, contacted my mum and said, we're worried about Kate. They'd seen me changing for games. And up until that point, I literally, everything was baggy and concealed my shape very well. And my mum had also had concerns. And basically, they smoked me out.
Yeah.
And sat me there and staged an intervention.
Yeah.
Part of me was livid and furious and terrified that I couldn't carry on as I was. But the other part of me was so exhausted and so ashamed and so sad that they can. I mean, I'd heard my mum call the Samaritans. I'd overheard her on the phone. She didn't know who else to talk to. And the shame and the guilt to this day, I could cry saying it to you now.
Yeah.
So I think that, again, for me, it, you know, there was an intervention that came along, and I, as much as I didn't know how to stop doing it, I just didn't know how I was going to carry on with it either, because I was exhausted.
Yeah.
You love yourself. You're going to exhaust yourself. It's as simple as that. And my grades had slipped at school. And the what I think for me, I always wanted to be successful in a profession. I wanted to be a career girl, which is not something I grew up with in a kind of role models around me. People, you know, my mum had a job and everybody worked, but they weren't careers.
Yeah.
I had ambitions to be more than that. And this doctor basically said to me, well, you're never going to do that. You're never going to get the grades you need. No one's going to give you a job because you can't be reliable because you're starving yourself.
Yeah.
I think the vanity and my ego of the desire to become successful became greater than my desire and my vanity to be thin.
So what was your first break in your career as a journalist?
Work experience.
Okay.
I used to do work experience as part of my... So I came to London with a suitcase full of Freeman's catalogue clothes.
Of course.
That I'd say furiously about. I came to London when I literally just finished my A-levels and I went on to study journalism, a diploma for a year, and I had to get a work placement. And that led to me getting a job. But I guess my really big break, I became a columnist very young, a very young columnist at 20 on Fleet Street, writing about youth and current, like youth and music and entertainment. And then from there went over to Smash Hits at 21.
And then became editor when you were 22.
No, 21.
Oh, you were 21, you were editor. Jesus Christ. I mean, that is, I look at my...
King, I wouldn't put me in charge.
Unbelievable. Isn't that, when I look at the kids today, there's no way. I don't know a single young person that would have the wherewithal to do that today.
Do you know what, you say that though, but actually the magazine was predominantly written for teenage girls.
You're so right. That makes total sense to have.
It made no sense in all the sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And it made no sense to me that I was the first woman to have been there.
Mm.
Like, hang on a minute. You've been going how long? And I'm the first woman in this chair? That was that astonished me.
Mm.
And then I had to, you know, I remember trying to convince them there that I should be able enabled to put, I really wanted to put the Spice Girls on the cover.
Mm.
And my publishers, I mean, really great guys, but all male.
Mm-hmm.
But like, they've got to have another one. I mean, I understood where they were coming from because historically, good-looking boys sold covers for us, right? You know, sort of issues. We put them on the cover. Girls tended not to sell. But I'm so convinced that these girls were different, and they did ultimately back me. But I had to kind of go and put a case forward for it. Yeah.
So they were happier to have take that breakup on the cover, because it was you were the first person to announce that, weren't you?
No. I'd got the job and was very excited about starting, and literally within the weeks of me accepting the job and starting, Take That split up, which was terribly unhelpful because they were literally cover gold.
Yeah.
So what I did is I spent like literally the first 3 or 4 months in the job just rinsing their demise. Memorial issue after memorial issue, solo career issues, you know, like, oh, here's the Mark Owen solo cover. Here's the Robbie Williams one. And then, you know, the year, the kind of book, the bookends of that year in pop music were Take That broke up. By the end of it, everyone was obsessed with girl power.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And then it was, I mean, Smash Hits was highly influential because it broke a lot of new bands, you know, launched them into a career. So do you remember any that that became well-known when you were working there?
Well, the Spice Girls, probably the best.
Probably the best, yeah.
Lots, actually. I mean, you're right, absolutely right. There were, like, these kind of touchstones that you had to hit to get into the charts back then. And it pretty much started with smash hits. If you got a good write-up in Smash Hits, or Smash Hits paid some attention to you, Radio 1 would probably then playlist you, which probably meant that you'd go into the charts, which meant that you'd end up on Top of the Pops. And those yeah. were three kind of key touchstones that you needed to hit to make it into the top 10. So I took that responsibility really quite seriously, you know, about trying to promote new artists and support them, and also new writers. But you know what's interesting? Because I did a film last year for the BBC, because Smash Hits would have been 40 years old. And I did it with Kylie Minogue and Henry Holland. And Henry was a stylist at Smash Hit. But when I was there, we didn't have stylists. And we wouldn't call in clothes for shoots. Bands would just literally turn up and we'd take their pictures.
Really? God, how times have changed. So what was the craziest outfits that walked through the studio door when you were doing a shoot?
Put this guy on the cover right at the beginning of the year called Jazz from Babylon Zoo. And it was one of those moments where I was like, we really can't do another take that memorial cover. What else have we got? This guy had come from nowhere and gone to number one. And he was really quite exotic as a pop star. He wore kind of fake, you know, face paints, and it was just out there. And kind of what Smash Hits should have always been about. So we put him on the cover. And all I remember is that, you know, literally, he looked like the Tin Man on acid.
Fantastic.
We also did one shoot with Peter Andre. I remember having to shade in his abs. So we body painted him as Superman. And then he wanted some more ab definition. So we literally had to run in on the shoot and shade it with some eyeshadow.
All hands on deck. Fantastic. Oh, and then with the, you moved into TV. And you did an ITV current affairs programme.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, fucking hell, is there anything you haven't done, woman? and then you did
a master of none.
And then you did, what was the story about Candle in the Wind when the Princess of Wales died?
Well, the day, sadly, the night, so we did this show every Sunday lunchtime and nobody saw it because it was on Against the East Enders omnibus, which was brilliant because I could just go and learn about telly.
Yeah.
But apart from my mum, I don't think anyone watched. And we would film it down at Meridian Television. So it was a network show, but it came out of the studios in Southampton. So I was living in the Novotel there with Nick Knowles, who was my co-host. And the night before the show, I had the news on quite late. And I saw the news break about Jodie Fayed had passed away and had been injured in the accident. We didn't think that we would ever be allowed to go on air. We were a bunch of young four hosts, really relatively experienced, inexperienced, me, totally experienced. You know, 7 or 8 hours of telly under my belt. And long story short, ITN decided that they needed the hour that we would have been on air to reconvene, to kind of, you know, recalibrate, I suppose, because, you know, all the ads stopped that day. There were no ad breaks. The whole of the programmes, the whole schedule for the day, with the exception of us that morning, were wiped, and it was just rolling news. And so they decided that we could go on because we were news and current affairs. And one of the jobs I had was I had to put together a package, a VT package, a video package, to play out at the end of the show that celebrated her as a princess of youth causes and young people. And I'd just got back from shooting in Ibiza and Bosnia, and I had no music. All I had in my car was rave music, indie music, and Elton John's greatest hits. And because it was a Sunday, our music library at the studios was closed, and we couldn't find anyone to open it. And the only thing I had in my car to go with this edit, this tribute package, was Candle in the Wind, because she was our Norma Jean.
Yeah,
and it felt like a good fit.
Yeah. So do you think that's why Elton John then
But I think once we played it, lots of people started using it as a sort of, I think it became
an anthem almost, didn't it, for her.
You know, they were playing that life. Version. Yeah. And I don't know whose decision it was to approach Elton to re-record it, but
it was very apt. And then, my love, you got picked up for The X Factor and did the first two seasons.
That was pretty.
Three. I did four seasons of the tour, And then, but before that, I'd done Pop Idol.
Of course, yes.
So actually, by that point, you know, you lump all that together. I did about 6 years of singing talent shows.
Yeah.
And Pop Idol I did because I knew Simon Fuller through working with him at Smash Hits on the Spice Girls, and also Simon Cowell because I'd also worked with him while I was at Smash Hits, where he was, you know, an A&R guy looking after Robson and Jerome and Fine and trying to put, you know, his A&R roster over to me to see if he could, you know, wanting covers and coverage. So I knew those two. So I moved into Pop Idol and then X Factor. Yeah.
And that was, I mean, did it, I can't remember, did it become, was it, it was a massive hit overnight, wasn't it, the X Factor?
Yeah, because I think it literally stood in, it stepped into some very warm shoes from Pop Idol. So I think no matter what came back, the appetite was there, you know, whether it had been Pop Idol or X Factor, the appetite was huge for that at the time. But I mean, literally the first season of Pop Idol was so exciting.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
That was so great. That was Will Young, wasn't it?
Will Young, Gareth Gates, and Gareth Dinesh.
No, it was such a great show, and I loved the fact that it was kind of cozier, wasn't it? It was cozier. It seemed sort of more real, almost.
It was entirely authentic in as much as there was no sort of, you know, shaping of stories. The one story that came in through the door really was almost ready made, I suppose, was Darius, because he'd been so ridiculed on Popstars: The Rivals for doing his Britney Spears scales, the over singing. And when he came in, I loved the rehabilitation of him in the eyes of the public, because he went from zero to hero. He was able to kind of almost repair the damage that had been done, because it is brutal. You know, you can't underestimate what happens when somebody is thrust into the public attention, public eye, and they're just kind of like left like a fish on the shore that's flapping around going, what the hell is this? It's terrifying. And, you know, there is a duty of care that I think is absolutely prevalent now, but at the time possibly wasn't. And I felt very protective towards Darius. I was willing him to do well and to come out of this show with, you know, his shoulders back and his head held high. And that's what happened. And he's a glorious man. I love him to pieces. We still speak from time to time. I have nothing but warmth and affection for him and Will and Gareth. But, you know, you had this kind of beautiful story with that first season. You had, you know, Gareth, who looked like a pin-up.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't speak, but he could sing like an angel.
Oh, his little stutter.
The moment when he walked into the audition room and tried to get his words out.
Yeah. You know,
the nation was willing him. You know, there was so much love and goodwill put his way. The same with Darius. I think people started out laughing, and by the end they were celebrating with him. He wasn't the joke anymore. And then Will, of course, came from nowhere. I remember Will was the very last person to be auditioned, and I'd already come across Will because I'd done a boy band search on This Morning with Simon Cowell, and we put Will Young in the band.
Okay, really?
And the band came to nothing. I mean, nothing happened. But it did also feature two members of Blue, who went on to become Blue. And Will was obviously madly articulate, beautiful singer, was able to stand up to Simon, and they had this kind of great sort of swordsman moment where they clashed, and you just didn't know what the outcome was going to be. And of course, you know, everybody thought Gareth was going to win, and then Will did. So you felt like you couldn't miss the next series because you couldn't call it. I remember going into work on the day of the final, and you know, I'm sat in the back of a taxi, and it's all over the radio. And then you look up at billboards, you know, the digital billboards, and it's part of the rolling news. And Anton Deck and I had been asked if we'd go and advise Parliament on how to persuade young people to vote. And it was just all a bit crazy and nuts. And it, yeah, it, I don't know that there'll be anything as exciting as that, because it felt so new. I know it wasn't. There's been talent shows.
Yeah.
For us, it felt very exciting.
Yeah. And then so what actually happened with you in the X Factor? Because did you resign, or what happened?
No, not at all. No, my contract wasn't renewed.
Okay.
And having been told that it would be, I then found out that it wasn't going to be. So, and that was that, really. I mean, it happens a lot in telly, but it was a big show.
Don't I know it? Yeah.
Well, you do. And, you know, I mean, it hurt a lot at the time, but it is, you know, it is what happens, and it's happened. It happened before that, and it's happened since, and I dare say it will happen again. But that's showbiz.
Yeah, it is. You're only as good as your last show, or what other people think.
Decision, and you know, it's his show. I get that.
Yeah, but it's kind of, you were so much a part of that show that it just seemed like, I do remember there being an outcry that your contract hadn't been renewed. And it just seemed like, and I can't even remember who came in place of you.
Dermot O'Leary.
Okay, I would say, yeah, okay. So maybe it was something to do with getting a bloke. Who knows?
I mean, I was certainly not privy to those conversations.
Yeah.
It happens. And, you know, no one likes a whinger. So I just got on with it.
Yeah, it's all you can do. If you can't change it, there's no point in whinging about it.
Really not, just, honestly. You know. And, you know, it changes you a lot. It never, you know, just because you're at top of the ratings doesn't mean that your job is secure.
Yeah.
I think that then, you know, ever since I've been very driven to create my own projects, just so that no one can fire me from them.
Yeah, also, and having more than one string to your bow. It's like, you know, I've been there. I've absolutely been there. You know, Trini and I were top of our game, and then suddenly we weren't. And it was like, we weren't doing anything else. You know, that was it. And it was like, part of me was relieved because we worked relentlessly hard. But then, you know, to coin a cliche, so many other doors opened, and then we started working all over the world, and I started writing, and then life changed. And without these kind of big disasters, for want of a better word, we don't grow, and we don't find other areas that we can hone and craft and hopefully become good at.
Totally. And I think, you know, sometimes when life puts you in a corner, you have to dig your way out. And what it forced me to do was stop being reactive and be proactive.
Yeah.
And actually, I am quite a good ideas person.
Yeah.
And I, you know, so I'm able to kind of create my own work that I kind of devise around, I guess, you know, my strengths. And it forced me to work harder for myself.
Yeah.
And have some autonomy. So now I do my podcast, which is my podcast, you know.
Yeah.
I make it, I write it, I present it, I produce it with a company who are great, but the idea is mine and I nurture it because that's my baby, you know. The jewellery, my baby. I love doing it. I work with a brilliant team. But it's something that I feel I have some kind of control over. And I think when you put yourself back out there as a jobbing presenter, which is ultimately what I am, then you're just at the mercy of somebody else's decision making. And often it's, you know, you could be doing perfectly well on a show, but then there's a change of guard, and every guard wants to change.
And have their influence.
and have their own people in, because they've got to prove that they were a good hiring, and they've got to show that they can make positive change, or change. And you get caught up in that, and it's just soul destroying at the time. So actually, I think, and in a life where we are driven by technology, never more so than in these last 12 months, we can't be the masters of our own creation and work for us, full-time publishers or broadcasters. Really enjoyed playing with that. But I totally resonate with what you say. You know, you have those moments where you're so busy and your life is just, you know, your diary is full month on month, year on year, and suddenly it stops. And there is, that's quite a frightening moment where you go,
Well, you become so defined by your work, and you forget that, well, I forgot who I was. And I think probably that's when my drinking escalated. Yeah, because it was like I almost went into mourning. I was like, who the fuck am I? You know, that was my identity. It wasn't Susanna. It was Trini and Susanna. You know, I'd walk down the street and people would see me and I'd be on my own or with my kids or something. And they'd go, oh, look, there's Trini and Susanna. You know, and Trini was fuck knows where. So, yeah, it's tough. But also, I mean, I'm sure you feel the same having done that. I mean, now with it, you've got a son who's 12. But for him, as a 12-year-old, now is the time when he needs you. It's like not when they're younger, I don't think. And even more so now that, I mean, my youngest is 17 and eldest is 22. But I am so glad I'm around at the moment and not, you know, travelling all over the world.
Well, that's... I think, you know, when I had Ben, I knew that I couldn't think of an ambition that remained unfulfilled.
Yeah.
You know, my favourite job, actually, that I ever did in telly was being a travel reporter. It was the most spectacular job in the world. I was paid, you know, to go to, you know, trek with the gorillas in Uganda, to climb Kilimanjaro, and I got to take my dad on that trip. You know, I did amazing things. I rafted through Ethiopia. It was just stunning, right?
Wow.
And then I did the big Saturday night shows, and I'd hosted Top of the Pops, and I presented on the Brits, and I was like, you know, I'm ready to not be the most important person in my world. So when I had Ben, that was it. I was like, he comes first, second, third, fourth, fifth on my list. He's like, he's my everything. And I turned down the opportunity to do breakfast television because I didn't want to miss the school runs. And I remember at the time there being this kind of like, you say no. I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm saying no. Because walking him to school to now, even now, like, thinking of that little hand in mine as we talked every day, I would never trade those times. Never. Not for any show. I've done 100 shows and hopefully we'll do 100 more, but no show is as important as real life moments. And you're right, he needs me more now than ever before.
Yeah, and they'll get to the point where he'll go, yeah, I don't need you, Mum, and that's when they need you even more.
Exactly, and I think what's interesting, I mean, maybe you felt different because I think you already had children when you went through that kind of identity crisis when the phone stops ringing or the booking stops coming in and you go, who am I? I'm not Trini and Susanna, I'm Susanna. And you have to rediscover yourself. I don't know, did you have kids then?
Yeah, I did. I had, all three,
That's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. But, you know... you just kind of get through it. But I was, you know, it was kind of a relief, you know. So it is that thing which you clearly understand. It's like you lose your identity, but then you find your identity as a woman and, for me, as a mother. And I wasn't really around when they were small. And then, now, you know, since then I've had the luxury and the privilege of watching them turn into adults. And so everything kind of, all worked out in the right way, in the right order, for the right reason. And, you know, even drinking alcoholically happened at the right time and for the right reason. And I've learned so much from it, and the wisdom that I've learned from that I can pass on to my children, and how they approach life and the anxieties and taking it slowly and one day at a time and la la la, it doesn't last, it'll pass. All these things, everything that's thrown at us is for a reason. I so believe that.
Oh, I completely believe that. And I think the tough times are the biggest lessons. And I, you know, I talk about this a lot on my own podcast, which I would love you to come on, by the way.
Except I don't drink.
Well, you don't have to.
Okay, fine.
Teetotalers on, don't you worry.
I have a Diet Coke, yeah.
I think, you know, we've got to stop calling our failures. They're not. They're massively educational. They're really important. And we're talking, you know, like, I think if I hadn't had to re-identify myself, when I was an anorexic, that's how I identified myself. Mm. I'm eight and I'm an anorexic. I'm secretly an anorexic. Mm. That was my identity. When it got to that moment where, for example, I was, you know, fired from the X Factor and I didn't know who I, you know, I'm going, oh God, I'm Kate off the X Factor. That it becomes so massive, that show, or Kate off the telly. And I became so, your identity is so caught up in your work persona, which is madly unhealthy. And you have to then, if I hadn't been an anorexic and had to re-identify myself from a very negative identity to something slightly more positive, I don't know that I would have been able to get back in the saddle as quickly. So actually all of those bad moments are great educators and they give you a much tougher skin. I know who I am. And what I learned through that period was I had to work out who I was again. What did I want? What makes my heart sing? You know, walking away from big job offers felt really risky, but right. So listen to that. Even when everybody around you is saying, are you sure? But you have to remember they're all saying that because they make out of that situation. Think about what you're going to make from that situation. And what I made was magical memories by not going into that situation, by being the mum at home. But don't get me wrong, I still worked. I just didn't up at 3 o'clock in the morning and have somebody do all the fun stuff with him that I went on to do. But those bad bits give you the muscles and the wisdom and the flex to go out there and do what's right for you. And it's really hard at the time to understand that when you feel like you're being a bit sort of kicked to the curb, there's power in that. There's magic in that.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you were going through the vulnerable times, how did dressing help you? Did you dress to, you know, because now you're very casual, as am I. I mean, I don't give a fuck about what I wear anymore. I mean, I do a little bit, but not so much because I'm more confident, because I'm happier. But when I wasn't, I would dress to represent this kind of confident, successful individual, which inside I wasn't. Did you ever do the same?
No, in fact, you know, when I went into telly, I felt a bit like Crocodile Dundee had just arrived in the city. I mean, I remember sitting when I was working at MTV and they gave me a makeup artist to teach me how to do my own makeup. And I remember her sitting down in the chair and going, so do you pluck your eyebrows? I was like, no, who does that? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I literally had no interest. I wore minimal makeup. I shaved my legs. That was about it. Never plucked my eyebrows, never painted my nails. I mean, it just wasn't, I just wanted to work. I think I felt that they were really uninteresting things to do and I had better things to do with my time. And that changed because then I started to see, well, actually, I do look a bit better if I pluck my eyebrows. And that wonderful makeup artist went on to work with me across my career and she's wonderful, Patsy O'Neill. And then I started to work with stylists and understand how to dress my shape, I guess. And there was something really wonderful in that. Just things like if you don't like yourself, just stick on a pair of bloody Spanx. Don't starve yourself for a week. Just wear Spanx for an hour. It's fine. There's always a shortcut. I wasn't madly big on clothes to begin with. Mainly, I think, because I felt so massively criticised for everything that I wore.
Really?
Everyone has an opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly doing those, like the X Factor, there would be literally meetings about my clothes. And it would all be from men.
Really? So did you fight that? Did they ever ask you to wear something which you refused to wear?
No, but they would ask to approve what I was wearing.
Yeah. God's sake. That makes my skin crawl.
I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. I was never a shrinking wallflower. I spoke for myself.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, maybe might have fired me. I don't know. Yeah. But I wasn't. I wasn't going to be dressed by committee, and certainly a bunch of middle-aged white guys.
Yeah. And did you ever have a wardrobe malfunction when your clothing really let you down?
Oh, God, shitloads, yeah.
Okay, what was the worst?
I think, I literally ran onto this morning, and literally as we were going, hello, good morning, welcome. Today I'm joined by blah, blah, blah. My whole dress just fell apart.
What?
Literally, I was standing in for Holly, I think, and Philip was very gallant in sort of allowing me to literally sit back in the chair while bulldog clips were sort of applied to me. So, yeah, I did a whole show with literally hanging by a thread.
Oh,
can't run off and get changed. There's not the time, is there? There's no news break.
Yeah.
Hand breaks, not big long enough to run to the dressing room, change, get all your sound packs back on. So just had to kind of muddle through with it. One of the most awful moments, I think, was, and I listened to your Prince Philip story, so it's not quite off, but it's not far off it. I was at one of the hotels on Park Lane hosting one of those events that you do in the ballrooms there, and it was for charity. It was for breast cancer care. And I was wearing a really beautiful black pencil skirt that I'd worn on the X Factor, actually, and I think it was a really fancy designer one. But it just gave me a really lovely, I mean, I'm curvy. I've always had like an in and out waist.
Yeah.
I think, well, wear it, you know. I was doing big bums way before they were fashionable. Yeah. So, you know, I've got this on and gets to the end of the show and I'm about to say, okay, this is how much money we've raised. And they get out one of those big comedy checks, you know.
Yeah.
And I have to invite onto the stage to present this, Cherie Blair, who is at the time the Prime Minister's wife.
Prime Minister's wife.
Yeah. Okay. So I got to the end of a catwalk to make this presentation with her. And as I'm walking down, I could just hear the room go silent. As I pass, I hear and all these I thought, God, what's happened? The back of my skirt completely gone. Literally gone. And I hadn't worn knickers because it was tight.
What, so it had split up the back?
Literally, I had literally the whole of my bum cleavage out, top to bottom. I've got quite a big bum, and it's all right, you know, I'm not ashamed of it. Didn't really want to put it on display in that moment with that crowd.
Could you feel it going?
I kind of fathomed from the crowd reaction what was happening. Cherie was so lovely. She put the fat comedy check behind me to cover my arse. And she was a brilliant female sister in that moment and really helped me out. And I was just like, well, do you know what? Listen, I've literally just shown myself in the most unflattering light. Before we close this check off, can I just ask you all to dig deep and just donate on behalf of my humiliation and lost dignity? And I'm giving more money.
Well done, you. Well done, you. That has to be one of the best wardrobe malfunctions I've heard.
I normally, I'm so prudish. I would never normally not wear
pants. Yeah.
Wear like a VPL thong or whatever, you know, one of those show. But this was, I remember this skirt so well. It was by Lanvin.
Yeah, Lanvin, yeah.
And it zipped and it was so figure hugging. I remember when I'd worn it on the X Factor, if I had to cross the stage, I literally had to do it really slowly because my legs wouldn't open far enough. The skirt was so tight, but it looked fabulous.
Yeah.
So it let me down horribly.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That is just tremendous. But you pulled it off. You pulled it off.
I had to turn it around because it was...
Yeah, you turned it around.
It's just one of those moments where it's the stuff of nightmares.
Mm.
It's like that nightmare of waking up naked on the train. And I have these horrible nightmares constantly where I'm not ready for a live show and I'm running around and I'm trying to find everything and I know that my boobs are going to fall out and they're not good anymore. I don't want them falling out. You know, it's all those mad kind of horrible...
Do you still have those dreams? Do you still have them? Really?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
Always when I'm running around looking for everybody and I know I should be somewhere and I'm not and it's going to take me ages to get there and I'm going to be late and I'm going to let people down. And it's really, really, yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? I have one recurring dream only, which, like you, I have to be somewhere, I have to get somewhere, and I've forgotten where I parked my car.
Oh, God, well, that's just real life for me. That's not even a dream.
Oh, my God. It's just horrendous.
I walk around car parks all the time, just pressing my key, just waiting for the light to flash somewhere. And I can go floor to...
Oh, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
No longer feels like my own some days.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, beyond those wardrobe malfunctions, I think, you know, I'm still also desperate not to be awkward or perceived as difficult. But on shoots, I'd end up saying yes, just so that I appeared to be easygoing.
Yeah. She's so easy to work with, that Kate. She's so easy. Our Kate is so easy to work. She's such a joy. Yeah.
Next, you go, what the hell? I look horrific. Why did I say yes to that? That happens a lot.
Yeah, that happens a lot. Oh, my God. I'm a people pleaser. I'm a terrible people pleaser. So you've travelled a lot. You've been through highs and lows. Has there been a comfort blanket for you that sort of stayed with you throughout this? It can be anything.
Books.
Really? Okay.
Because they're a brilliant gateway to somewhere else.
I'm an obsessive reader as well.
I am. And
yeah,
I really look forward to getting into bed to read my book. And in pre-COVID life, I've got my Kindle on my phone as well. So literally the moment I was on and off a tube, I would just get another quick chapter.
Yeah.
Bookshops are my favourite shops.
Yeah. Yeah, same.
Now, like silence.
What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a book called Diamonds in the Lost and Found, which is kind of a memoir, which is really lovely. About a really weird and wonderful childhood. I've just read Shobhana Gulati's memoir, Remember Me, Discovering My Mother as She Lost Her Memory. And it's such a beautiful book. It's about her mum having these moments of huge lucidity as she was in the grips of dementia, and Shobhana furiously writing it all down so that she got to know her mum away from being just a mum in those last stages of life. That was beautiful.
Kate, you've met everyone, especially in the music business. Is there anyone whose style has blown you away?
So many, but the one that I always go back to, because she is so simply stylish.
I know who you're going to say.
Sade?
Oh, no. No, really? I thought you were going to say Annie Lennox.
Also amazing. Yeah. Stylish. But Sade.
Sade. Okay.
I've never seen anyone that can do jeans and a white shirt like her.
Mm.
And still to this day, in her 60th year, she is a remarkably stylish and just a lovely woman.
Yeah.
I was really quite blown away when I met her.
Yeah.
So many levels. But yeah.
All right, my darling. So final question, my angel. Do you have an outfit that you would like to be remembered for? Something that makes you feel fabulous?
Yes.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I have got next door, and it was one of my dresses. So for 5 years, I hosted the Strictly live tours. I don't know if you did the live tour around the arena.
No, I was out first, so no.
Ah, how dare they?
Yeah.
How dare they? So I would be the sort of Tess and Claudia on these shows, and I had the most stunning wardrobe. And what's the name of the Australian designer? Is it Rachel Gilbert?
Yeah, there's Rachel Gilbert or Rachel Comey.
Rachel Gilbert. And it is I literally look like the dancing lady emoji. It's a red full-length sequin dress that kicks out at the bottom, hugs in all the right places. It's got these beautiful little cap sleeves, and you can move in it. I mean, it's got a stretch to it, which is quite everything else that you wear in that sort of evening couture vibe is very corseted and structured, and this is just gloriously lovely. So actually, it's probably the dress I'd like to be buried in.
Oh, nice. So it could be a birthday suit and a burial suit.
Why not?
Hello, two for the price of one. All right, darling. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go, but I tell you, we've been talking for a long time. I could keep talking to you for another 3 hours.
It's well, good, brilliant. I'm going to have you come and sit on White Wine Question Time.
I would love to do it. I would really. You're just heaven. I love you.
But I just wanted to say thanks to you because 12 years ago, I don't know if you'll even remember this, but we were on the same flight going out to New York.
Yes.
On the 60th.
Yes.
Well, I remember just being And you were with Patrick Cox and David Furnish, and I've been hired to host the event for ITV. But you guys were all such great friends, and you were so inclusive of me on the flight. And you and Trini, when you found out I was pregnant, literally strong-armed me into some support socks, because you said, you're going to get thrombosis and you need to, and you just looked after me so beautifully. So thank you. It was a great act of kindness, and never forgotten.
Oh, darling. No, well, you are heaven. And read my lips. I will see you soon, okay? And I would love to come and do your podcast, please.
Love that too.
All right, lots of love.
Thanks, Kate. I loved speaking to her and can't wait to come on her podcast. You can check out Kate's jewellery range by going to bbbijou.com. Find the link in our show notes. Right, before we go, here's a little treat. A track from our house band duo's brand new Gig in Your Garden album. It's called Zorbaba, and you'll very quickly see why. And Zorba. I love it. Find Gig in Your Garden by Duo on our show notes or by going to duoguitarmusic.com or at Duo Guitar Music on their socials. Right, before we go, you can find us on our website mywardmal.com. Follow us at mywardmal on our socials, and if you have a moment, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on your chosen podcast platform.
That's it. Thanks again to Kate and to Duo. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.